The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this October 3rd, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. If you haven't already, I really encourage you to follow us on iTunes, Writers on Writing. You will get notifications when we podcast new shows. You can get our past shows up there. If you're so inclined and want to help us out, we would love for you to leave a little review of the show up there to help raise our profile. You can also follow us on Facebook. We're under Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. You can follow KUCI in general on Facebook, KUCI FM. And we're on Twitter, Barbara's website, penonfire.com, mine, mariestone.com. And one other quick announcement. We have another wonderful speaker series coming up on October 16th. That is roughly 2 weeks from yesterday. Todd Goldberg, who was on the show last week, and Deborah Reed will be there. Those are all held at Lido Books. Awesome opportunities to listen to writers. Make sure you register for those, because last time we had a bunch of people who walked in and were turned away because it was sold out. So if you are interested in doing that, definitely register. You can go on to Barbara's website, Pen on Fire, to register for that. Super important that you buy your tickets in advance, because turning people away was absolutely no fun at all. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. We are living through some grisly times these days, and the women on this morning are going to reflect a lot of the themes we're all living through every single day. Christina Dalcher is on with me now, and poet Donna Hilbert will join me for the second half. Christina Dalcher earned her doctorate in theoretical linguistics from Georgetown University. She specializes in the phonetics of sound change in Italian and British dialects and has taught at several universities. Her short stories and flash fiction appear in more than 100 journals worldwide. Recognition includes the Bath Flash Award shortlist, nominations for the Pushcart Prize, and multiple other awards. Her debut novel is Vox. It's published by Berkeley Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Christina, welcome.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, thanks for coming on. What a timely gift our world has delivered to this novel, which feels perhaps more terrifying and important than ever these days. So before we dive too far into this, I'm going to let you introduce the book so listeners who haven't yet read Vox kind of understand the scope and the world we're talking about here. Can you kind of take us into Vox and introduce us to these characters in this world?
Absolutely. We've got a very normal world in Vox, and you see that especially in the opening scene where our main character, Jean McClellan, a neurolinguist, is having an everyday post-work, post-school dinner with her family. Except what we find out really on that first page is that things are not normal. I think it looks like today everything is sort of the same as we would expect it to be, except for one tiny difference. The women in this world, and by women I mean all females, women, the young daughters, female babies, have been fitted with a bracelet of sorts that counts their words on a daily basis, and they are permitted 100 words per day. Now, why is this the case? Well, it's quite simple, actually. We've got a faction of extreme religious fundamentalists who've effectively bought the presidency of the United States, because what they want more than anything is to go back, really turn the clock back and reverse our past and revisit a culture of domesticity. That is a culture where men are in the public sphere and women are confined to the private sphere, which is the home.
So talk about your door into this. When you first conceived of this novel, did it start with that idea? Did it start with a character? Did it start with the really awesome situation we currently find ourselves in?
That's an excellent question. And right. So interestingly enough, first of all, I write a lot, as you mentioned, I write a lot of flash fiction. And flash fiction, for anyone who isn't aware of this form, this literary form, it's fiction that is generally less than 1,000 words, very, very often much, much shorter than that, 500 words, 300 words, a paragraph, sometimes down to a few sentences. And we've got different names for, you know, the 100-word story, the 50-word story, the 140-character story, and so on. So the idea for Vox started with a very different take. I was trying to write a story about a doomsday scenario, and since I'm a linguist, I thought that I would start with something that is, you know, very obvious to me, but perhaps not very obvious to people who haven't studied formal linguistics. And that was, what would happen to our world if suddenly people were not able to speak or comprehend speech at all? And I'm talking about language, really. So either speech or signed language, it doesn't really matter because there's no real difference between these, except that one uses vocal apparatus and the other uses gestures. So I anticipated that the world would probably degrade into chaos within a very, very short time. And that kind of frightened me. I wanted to take this farther, though. So I then wrote a short story. And the short story submission guidelines for this particular market had an interesting set of parameters, which really helped me quite a bit, because instead of starting from zero, I was starting from something much more than zero. I needed to write a story with a female protagonist who had a specific set of skills that was central to the plot. So going back on my language law / aphasia / fiction piece, I built a much richer story around that, involving a woman who used to work in repairing victims of language loss or aphasia and giving them back their language. But in the process of doing that, really forgot to use her own and expected that the world would continue as it always had. And in fact, that's not what happened. While she wasn't paying attention, the world changed. And this woman who dedicated her life and her research to repairing language deficits ended up losing her own voice.
Interesting. Something you said earlier about the 140 character, you know, obviously reminded me of Twitter and how much how much damage even very small words can have on our society. I mean, you and I deal in language all day long. I think, you know, I mean, we're both traders in words. And so I think we both have, you know, an appreciation for its power and what it can do and what it, for both good and evil. And, but bringing that so viscerally to the reader in the way you did, it really was just terrifying. I was reading this, you know, last week with, if listeners are listening to the podcast, we're right in the middle of all the Kavanaugh hearings and all of those things. So reading it, right, I just had to put it down so many times because
I've
so
heard a
depressing.
Lot of readers say that.
It was so depressing.
I know. Well, I mean, I'm flattered, actually. I take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a much better, you know, I put it down because it disturbed me. Obviously, if people had started saying, I put it down because I was so bored with Dalcher's, you know, 10-page description of the color of leaves on the trees, I don't know. That I probably wouldn't take as a compliment.
No, I mean, it was so realistic and so terrifying. And as you said, you set it up in a very normal-looking world that turned on its head very, very quickly. And we should add that the female characters also are not allowed to read. They don't have access to books. So they have access to no words written they can listen to what their male husbands say. And then they have these indoctrinating sort of speeches that, you know, under extreme circumstances, they also have to repeat these words. So that's another way that words hold so much power over them, is to, you know, giving themselves propaganda to change their mind.
Absolutely. And of course, the reason the books are locked away, which think I tend to overlook this sometimes. It's really not because they don't want the women to read. It's because they don't want the young girls to start reading. They don't. They really want to. I think the idea is not to just prevent females from speaking, but to actually degrade their linguistic ability to such an extent that females are actually rendered, less human in some ways. I mean, if we look at language as the one thing that sets us, we humans, apart from the rest of the animal kingdom, right? I mean, that's it. That's what we have. That and our larger brain size. But language is in my mind really the critical factor here. It draws that bright line between Homo sapiens and every other living animate thing. So with this kind of a story, I was really looking to talk about what the goal was here. And I think the goal in some ways was to dehumanize a part of society, sort of in a step for life kind of a fashion, right? I mean, except Ira Levin, back in 1971 or so, he was using, Disney-esque robots and, animatrons. And I didn't go that far. I took the easier way. Why complicate things by turning them into robots when all you really do need to do is limit their access to language?
Right, right. Well, you must have done the research on this, but I would imagine that if you take away a person's language, you probably are also diminishing their mental capacity to come up with ideas if you're not communicating or able to exchange ideas with people. I imagine that part of your brain function also goes down.
Sure, we would see this particularly in the younger generation. You know, these children like Jean's daughter, Sonia, who is 6 years old in the novel, she is still very much in the window of that critical period for language acquisition, right, which lasts about until puberty, 14, 15 years old. And we know from very, very rare examples of feral children, wild children, and sauvage, that if humans do not acquire a first language within that critical period window, they are at severe risk for not acquiring it at all. Now, there's a difference, though, between Jean and any adult female in Vox and these younger people who are still in that critical period. Jean has her language. Even if she can't speak, she's still got her language, right? She can speak to herself. She can't utter words aloud, but she can think, she can process information, she can rationalize, she can cook, she can do all of these things, she can drive a car, she can do all these things that language, I think, is necessary for. The younger generation, on the other hand, are, as you say, at risk for not developing language, and therefore, in my mind, at risk for not becoming, robust thinkers.
Right, right. Oof. My guest this morning is Christina Dalcher. The book is Vox. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So let's switch our discussion a little bit from content to craft, since we're talking to all these writers out there who I know are curious how you did this. The first thing I wanted to dive into is your love of flash fiction, because I, too, have a huge love of writing and reading flash fiction. And
I'm so glad to hear that.
I just love the form, and I kind of love the form for all the reasons you were talking about earlier. And it's a great way to generate ideas and give you sort of at least something to jump off from. But it's hard.
Yeah.
I do think it's hard to go from 100 words to 80,000 words in a novel.
Well, it is, Marie. And, and it's funny because the number of times people have asked me things like, so what's the difference between writing flash fiction and a novel? my response is 80,000 words.
Right.
Now, so here are a couple of interesting points. One, I did not start it. When I started writing just over 4 years ago, I did not start writing flash fiction because I hadn't heard of flash fiction. Didn't know what it was. I didn't really know anything about writing at all. I had to, look up things on the internet along the lines of how to write a novel, right? I was basically looking for an instruction book because this is not something that I'd had exposure to, and it's not something that I ever learned, so I had to teach myself. But my idea was to go out there and write a novel. I was going to write a thriller, darn it. And, you know, and I did. You know, I signed up for National Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, which is in the month of November. So any writers out there who are looking to participate in National Novel Writing Month, you know, you've got, 28 days
right?
To, you know, figure that out before you start, before you leave the gate and start running. You know, and that novel actually was fine. It has not been published, but it did score me literary representation, agent representation, fairly quickly, which kind of, you know, bolstered my own sense of, okay, Belcher, maybe you can do this. Okay. But in the meantime, while that was being revised and when it was out on submission, I fell into this marvelous group of flash fiction writers that I found on Twitter, of all places, and I started writing these very short pieces. And I found that this was just fantastic because I could use all kinds of different ideas. You know, I could explore, one day I could explore, you know, loss after the death of a loved one, you know, grieving in kind of an experimental way. Another day I could write a story about an old house that had been taken over by weeping willows that had gone rampant. And, you know, another story might have been about a cat burglar who was actually a cat. So it just was so interesting to be able to do all these different characters and voices and to write something in a very, very short amount of time, you know, polish it up, send it out, and watch it get accepted and have people say, hey, this is good. I really liked this. This was either funny or it was thrilling or it was horrific. Or it was good satire. And so in a way, the flash fiction pieces that I've written are, they're kind of like itches, you know, like these little studies that you know, that composers do. And I know nothing about music, but I know that an etude is like shorter than, say, a symphony. So, you know, instead of going out to write a symphony before you know anything about writing, like I was doing, writing a novel before I knew anything about writing, it was really helpful to kind of work on that craft in these short and almost instantly gratifying ways.
Yeah.
You know, the problem with a novel is that, oh, that 80,000 word mark is really far away. The great thing about flash fiction is that 300 word mark is just a half an hour away.
So tell me a little bit about, I mean, the thing that I find difficult jumping from flash fiction or short stories to novels is, you know, you have to sustain multiple characters, multiple themes, plot points. Plotting is just, you know, a nightmare for me. So talk a little bit about your process with this novel, if there was an outline involved, where the big surprises came. There's a lot of, you know, character decision trees that pop up in this book, you know, where something happens and the character needs to make a choice. So talk about kind of what your office looks like in structuring this novel over that amount of time.
Well, my office at the time I wrote this was a tiny little round table that was just large enough for my laptop and maybe a cup of coffee or something. I do everything on what's called a beat sheet. So if anybody out there listening is familiar with Blake Snyder or with his book, which is a method kind of a book called Save the Cat.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And because there always has to be a cat that needs to be a metaphorical cat that needs to be saved, right, in a novel. So that we're, or at least that's what Snyder is saying, so that we can, you know, root for someone, you know, the person who's going to save this cat. Just like, let's say, the adult scientists in Jurassic Park had to save those kids, right, once they all got stuck on the island together and the power went out. So I do start with a beat sheet. It is about, 15 beats. soulful, right? Going from opening image, you know, to the statement of the theme, the catalyst, the debate, you know, the launch into act two and everything changes, and all the way through that, through the final image. And I find that that really helps. If I can't get all the beats down in a beat sheet before I start writing, at this point, I think I realize that I should not start writing. I need to iron this out because that sequence of beats really is the story. But they're short. They're, you know, a sentence long, really. Mm-hmm. And so that's the outline. Everything else, I don't do character sheets. I have in my head, I guess, you know, characters, kind of goals and motivation. But most of the things that happen in between those beats that I've written down prior to starting happen, I would say, sort of spontaneously. Like, I'll start writing, and I know where I'm going, and I know I have to get from point A to point B. So how can I do that? So, for instance, Stephen is in Vox, is Jean's oldest son. She's got four kids. Her oldest son, in his late teens, has embraced this pure movement, this fundamentalist movement that has decided to kind of go back to a sort of biblical separation of gender roles. And he's embraced this. He's being indoctrinated at school. He's being, you know, there's peer pressure. There are all kinds of reasons that he does this. He's actually not as evil as he sounds. He's really a victim in many, many ways. And I did find some sympathy for him. But early on, when I started writing him, I thought, oh, wow, you know, teenage kid, what would a teenage kid do? And so his whole story arc really was not in that original plan. It just kind of happened. And so I think there's maybe a balance, to sum up, I think there's a balance between outlining and overplotting.
Right.
Because, you know, if you overplot, then maybe I have a fear of being stuck, you know, with that. So it's much better for me to kind of take that bare bones beat sheet and then start writing and then see what begins to happen.
Right, right. And the chapters are fairly short, so I mean, you could almost think of it in your writer head as, okay, I'm just writing a flash fiction chapter, and then, you know.
I do sometimes. In fact, there's one chapter in Vox that's early on. It's probably the fifth or sixth chapter, maybe. And it is very short. It's, you know, the whole book is from Jean's point of view. It's first person. It's present tense. So we're really seeing the world through her eyes, which I think is a good thing, because really this is her story, right? This is Jean's story. It's not necessarily, a commentary on the entire world and on what everybody else thinks. It's what this one woman, wife, mother, lover, you know, doctor, colleague is experiencing. So there's one scene early on where she's in bed with her husband and they're making love, and she is not able to even say his name. She's not able to say anything to him because she's run out of words for the day. Her word counter won't reset for another few hours. And so she's thinking about this, and she's thinking, you know, going through the motions of having sex while she's thinking about this, you know, what it's like not to be able to talk, even in this, you know, very intimate kind of an experience. And so to go back to your observation that there are some scenes or very short chapters that read like flash fiction. In fact, that was one of the first scenes that I wrote, and I wrote it as almost as a flash fiction piece, with a couple of minor changes just to take out any reference to the bigger plot in Vox. I was able to submit that to a flash fiction journal, and it won first prize. So, it's a good observation, but it's actually true. Sometimes you just have these ideas, you know, that you know you need to get down. Otherwise, I write very linearly because I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Right, right. Do you find that this sort of feels like, you know, I think a lot of writers are told to write to their greatest fears or to sort of live in the dark and go deeper into the dark. And I was wondering, A, how you wrote this without, you know, really hating all the men in your life, because that's how I felt reading it.
Well, I don't hate men. I've never been one to hate men.
I don't. That
would be unfair. And also, there are women in Vox who are complicit.
Yes, right.
You know, there are women who have embraced this idea of a Stepford Wife kind of a society, of this return to, you know, those lovely halcyon days of the 1950s and father knows best and leave it to Beaver, right? They think their lives would be simpler that way. So I can't say that it was all, you know, this all happened at the hands of, you know, only men in Vox anyway. What I was more fearful of, and I am, you know, very fearful of this, I'm fearful of too much government control. And I think any writer of dystopian fiction has a fear of that because, hey, when we come down to it, all dystopias are about a large government, a totalitarian state, and some, you know, small helpless individual who is the victim, who has no voice, right? I just took that and made it very literal. You really don't have a voice. So did it make me angry? Yes, but it made me fearful. But it made me much more fearful. I wasn't directing my anger at any one particular sex. I was rather directing it at the idea that, oh God, you know, how could we let this happen? How could any group, and it could have been a different group, right? You know, I chose, you know, extreme fundamentalist, Christians, you know, from the Bible Belt, but it could have been any group that had done this. And it might have been a slightly different story, but I think Jean's story and Jean's arc really would have been very, very much the same.
Right, right. I'd love for you to put us onto a few of these flash fiction resources of where you find contests or prompts or places to submit. Is there kind of a wealth of resources you could you could give us here?
Sure. Well, There are a number of people. Basically, I think pretty much everybody I follow on Twitter who's not an editor or an agent or a publicist or something like that, or a literary, is either a flash fiction, literary journal, whether online or in print, or a flash fiction writer. So one thing you can do, you don't need to follow me on Twitter. But you can look at who I do follow, and you'll find that they're probably, these journals. Also on my website, there is a page, under my writing page, there's a shorts and flash subpage, and I've listed, you know, all of my publications there with links to them. So, again, it's not necessarily a plug for my short fiction, but if you do follow those links, you'll get to some of these websites, some of these journals' websites. And then two that I would like to mention in particular, because one had something to do with Vox, and the other is just so wonderful and has gone so global, and they do so many things for Flash, including hosting an annual festival now in the Bath, Bristol area of the UK. That's Bath Flash Fiction, and that's Bath as in bathtub, right, as in the city in England called Bath. So the Bath Flash Fiction Award, which is easy to find, has a quarterly, I think, or thrice yearly contest. And they do a whole bunch of other things, and they're great supporters of Flash writers. And the other one that I like to give a plug to is the Molotov Cocktail, which is also Googleable. I believe it's themolotovcocktail.com. They run a number of Flash contests every year, and they embrace the dark side of fiction writing. That is, in fact, where my Flash fiction, Wernicke 27X, that was the title, the one about the aphasia that was sort of ruining the world. That was where it was published. So I feel like I owe the Molotov Cocktail a really great big hug and a shout out.
Well, I know you aren't endorsing your own website, but I will do it for you. It's a wonderful, wonderful website. And I know, and it's your name, right? ChristinaDulcher.com.
It is.
Okay.
Easier for me to remember that way.
Yeah, right. Me too. But yeah, I completely fell into your many, many flash fiction. It's funny because I started reading your flash fiction and then I started scrolling down. I'm like, oh my God, she really did publish in over 100 journals. This goes on forever.
I know. And it's quite sad because last year, and in 2017, I think I had about 65 flash pieces published. And I was I felt like I was on the biggest roll of my life. This year, no. I've been writing novels.
I was going to say, as between the trade-off, I think that's not a bad one. I think that's a good one.
Well, it's not a bad one, but I have to say, I think my first love really is flash fiction.
Yeah.
It really, really is. And so I'm hoping to get back to that. But in between the bigger stories do pull me.
I love it. Christina Dalcher, congratulations on Vox. It is wonderful. Congratulations on the 100 pieces of flash fiction you've had published. And you only started this 3 years ago. It's amazing. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Maria. It was my pleasure.
Mine too.
Really lovely talking to you.
Thank you. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Donna Hilbert will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Search for Writers on Writing. We pop right up. And again, as I mentioned, the first half hour, we have another speaker series event coming up in 2 weeks, still at Lido Books. October 16th, Todd Goldberg, who was on the show with Barbara last week, will be there, as well as Deborah Reed. Check out penonfire.com to get tickets. Do not show up without a ticket because we had to turn people away last time. So walk-ins are dicey. These events have been selling out, so try and get your tickets early, early and often. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Donna Hilbert's earlier books, Before Gravity, which is what we're talking about today. Her earlier books include The Congress of Luminous Bodies from Aortic Books, The Green Season, which is poems, stories, and essays from World Parade Books, Mansions and Deep Red from Event Horizon, Transforming Matter and Traveler in Paradise from Pearl Editions. She was on the show with Barbara all the way back in 2006 for that collection. Her poems are online at A Year of Being Here, Little Eagles Reverse, all over the place. Her work is anthologized, most recently in Poetry of Presence by Grayson Books. Donna has led workshops for both beginners and professional writers in venues as varied as men's prisons, an English public school, and literary programs. She writes and leads private workshops in Long Beach, California. Her latest collection, again, is Gravity. It's published by Tebow Bach. It's what we will chat about this morning. Donna, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, Marie.
Am I saying the publisher right? Is it Tebow Bach?
Or... It's Tebot Bach.
Tebot Bach.
Tebot Bach is Little Teapot in Welsh.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very cool.
It's sweet. I'm not a tea drinker, nevertheless. I like the publisher.
Yeah, right? That's funny. So I thought you'd been on the show with me before, but then I realized you were the subject of a documentary years ago, Grief Becomes Her, and the filmmaker was on the show talking about you.
Yes.
I think you were.
That's right.
Maybe you were also here as well, but I knew we had crossed paths over. I know we've crossed paths in life. I thought we'd cross paths on the radio. So that's just.
Nope, just hearsay.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'm going to let you kind of, we're going to set the stage. So I'm going to kind of let you introduce the collection and kind of talk about what's been on your mind. You have so many collections out, but talk about what's kind of been on your mind with this one and how these poems came together.
Well, I don't like, it's an important collection for me. I reached back to some early poems and a couple of my most recent publishers kind of went under shortly after my books were published, and I wanted to rescue a few poems from those collections. And then there's a pretty hefty section of new poems. I was fortunate enough to be the recipient of a residency at Door County, Wisconsin, where I've had,
think I've been there 3 years now.
Yeah.
I really had an opportunity to put this book in order a couple of years ago during my stay. I was able to do so much work. It would have taken me 6 months. I had 2 weeks of nothing but time to order, to think about it, to think about how the poems would go together. And it was really a gift. So I want to give a shout out to Writer in Door County in the beautiful, beautiful Wisconsin lake area.
Hmm. I'm always curious, but I'm going to stop you there and just say, so many of these, right? I have never done a writer's residency like that, but it's definitely on my bucket list. I feel like I would get out there and just be terrified to sit alone with my dark self in a cabin for a couple of weeks. But it sounds like that's not the case for you.
It's heaven for me. The first 2 days of each residency, all I do is sleep, basically. Yeah. I'm so exhausted the time I arrive there that I, you know, get up, have breakfast, and take a morning nap, which is, you know, who does that? So the first couple of days are just unwinding, relaxing, letting go of everything that, you know, the baggage I've carried with me. Mm-hmm. And then it is just a wonderful experience. I mean, I don't always do what I think I'm going to do when I'm there. But the reading, the writing, the just time to do nothing but immerse myself in poetry. I mean, perhaps I'll only have one or two new poems come out of it, or perhaps I'll have an idea for a workshop, or in the case of putting Gravity together, I spent the time deciding what poems to include, what order they should be in. There was originally, it was going to be called In the Orchards of Our Mothers, because there was this, like, magnum opus I was trying to force out of myself. I could never finish that poem. So I had to abandon the idea that that would be the name of the book and abandon the idea that this long and complicated poem would be a part of it. Had I not had all of that time of reflection and effort, I would have probably kept banging away on something that just wasn't going to come to fruition. But having, you know, a meditative stretch of time, I realized that wasn't going to work. I had an idea about what might, and so then I was able to put the collection together.
Do you think it's?
I added a few more poems over the next year, but it took its shape during that residency. Yeah. And last year, during the residency, I came with the book and had a little party.
That's
pretty exciting.
Do you think it's not just the time, but it's just being out of your own environment to see your life more clearly that you can't see when you're sitting in your own kitchen?
I think so. You know, modern life is so complicated, and I know mine isn't any more complicated or hectic or, you know, sometimes annoying than anyone else's, but it is very busy. It is very full of distraction.
Yeah.
There isn't a day goes by that, you know, I'm not asked to do something for someone, whether it's family or, you know, writer friends or my partner. My dog. I mean, it's crammed full of distraction.
Right.
And I live in a scenic place that one would think would be very conducive to inspiration and writing, but in fact, it's pretty distracting.
Yeah.
It might be too pretty.
Yeah, right.
And too noisy.
Yeah. I find because some of the best writing gets done, like, in the car staring at a brick wall or something rather than staring out at the ocean.
That's the way it is for me, too. I really need a little sensory deprivation.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get.
Yeah, right. We were talking last night kind of just by text or Skype or whatever we were, Messenger, about, I think that the beauty of poetry is that you can work out a lot of your internal, well, I don't write poetry, but I work out a lot of my internal stuff by reading it. And this difference between poetry as therapy versus poetry as art, and as you're trying to work through your own muck, not turning it into a therapy session, but turning it into real art. And I wonder if you could talk about that and how to do that and how to know when you're not doing it, how to know, you know, when it is turning into a therapy session instead of turning into something universal and rising above itself.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's it.
I didn't want to step on your...
Yeah, no, go.
Well, by reading a lot of poetry, I think one will discover the difference. There's a quote, I read an interview with Terry Gross in the New York Times a while back, and she was talking about interviewing others and what she got out of it. And she quotes John Updike, and she says, "We offer up our own stories as what John Updike called specimen lives, examples of what it's like to be human." And I really think that in writing poetry, I know for me, I try to go beyond the details of my personal experience. Although, you know, it is my story. I try to bring it to a point where it can be offered up as a specimen life, not just as, you know, Donna done dirty once again, or Donna doing somebody dirty once again. But something that has a little more universal application. And I think one way to achieve that is really from the music, from the, you know, presenting it in a way that is powerful, truthful, and palatable to another person. And I think that's where the art comes in. I mean, therapy is best done in a therapist's office. You know, whatever internal help one gets making art, I mean, that's great. I'm for it. But when I teach a workshop, it's not about therapy, although I try to make it as safe an environment as a group therapy session would be, in that nothing gets repeated and we don't hector one another for more details. But my aim is art, not therapy. And it's sort of like, you know, the classic discussion of pornography. I can't tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it. And it's the same with a poem that's therapy or a poem that's art. I can't exactly tell you, but I know.
Right.
And if you read enough poems, you will know too.
Yeah.
And, there's no teacher like a book of good poetry. Although I certainly encourage people to come to my workshops, they can do a great deal for themselves by just simply reading, and then reading some more.
So we're told as fiction writers to not self-censor and to, you know, just write. And I don't know if that works for poetry. Does that work for poetry too?
Absolutely. Okay. You don't need to show everybody all of this, however. I have very definite feelings about how to go about it. And, of course, it's based on what I do, because what else? You know, that's all I've got.
Yeah.
Longhand, I just beg people not to go directly to a keyboard. Mm. Many, many, many longhand drafts with some kind of a writing instrument that just flows like, you know, easy, easy. And, of course, I am addicted to my Lamy fountain pen, my Rhodia notepad. The ink, the pen is so lovely to work with. The paper is so soft, and everything just glides. So when I write, I try not to think about what I'm putting down, really. I'm sort of in love with the feel of the pen in my hand and the ink flowing onto the page. And I like to be surprised a little. I might think I'm writing about one thing, and it turns out, oh, it's entirely different. But I know one thing for certain, like my story of the poem that I was trying to write, which was going to be so epic and fab that I would name a book in that poem. You sit down knowing what you're going to do, you're probably already finished. Hmm. I don't think I've ever written a good poem from an intention to write.
Hmm. It sounds
I would probably start with a musical phrase of some sort, and I would be so, you know, I would be so happy with that sound of that phrase that I'll write it down. And then something else will happen. And then after many, 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 many drafts, I'll have a poem. Mm. I am a believer in revision. So when you know that you're going to write 100 drafts, say, just pick a number, then you don't have to be so concerned about what you write down. Because, you know, it's just the beginning. It's not an end. And I think it's freedom.
Yeah.
I think Annie Lamott is famous for saying shitty first drafts. And I would say maybe shitty first 20 drafts.
Yeah, right.
Because
right.
Poems are short. You know, you can write many drafts of a poem and not
right.
feel persecuted right. from the effort.
It almost sounds, as you're talking about it, that you write almost from like this dream state. Like, I don't know if you get up super early in the morning when you're still in that kind of, you know, reality hasn't quite.
I think that's
it.
The state I live in.
It's a great state for me.
I'm a citizen of the dream state.
I'm always trying
to access
that.
That's not a bad way to put it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, just trying to access that all day long, if you can access it at 11 a.m. instead of, you know, 5 a.m., all the better. But I do think a lot of really interesting stuff comes out of that unconscious kind of letting yourself, you know, go state.
Absolutely. I can't imagine. I mean, I absolutely feel that way.
Yeah. Well, let's
I think
take...
it was...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just...
The unconscious mind is brilliant.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Just in general, it's a general statement. It's all that's under the surface. Knows more than we do.
Yes.
In our conscious state, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it doesn't try to dictate where things are going, so that, you know, I think, as you said before, if the writer knows where something's going, the reader is going to know where it's going, and if there's no surprise for anyone, it's really loses a lot of interest for...
Absolutely.
And
sometimes I know from the first few lines whether a poem is, you know, doomed or not. I mean, when I'm reading one or trying to write one, the first line is important, and boy, you better bring it home in the last line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's take one of these. We'll probably only have time to do one, but is there a poem in here that you can first read to us, and then we can kind of talk about all the principles that we've been talking about so far of how you got into it and how you revised it?
I know you had mentioned a poem about my father in here, but it was so written so long ago, I have no idea how I revised it.
Okay.
So perhaps I'll take one from the new section of the book, which is a little more... at hand, and I...
Okay.
Okay. What to believe. You worship at the church of the open court in shorts, T-shirt, and red bandana, playing tennis Sunday mornings once we'd given up on Mass. Slow coffee and music were a kind of church for me, so the boys and I stayed back in our pajamas, turned the radio to 94.7, a little bit of heaven, KMET, KMET. A bit of heaven, too, the mere act of flipping pancakes onto a stack, crowning with butter and genuine maple syrup, pouring icy milk into Looney Tunes glasses, giveaways from the fast food joint where we ate most Friday nights. Breakfast with the Beatles, all the Beatles, still alive. Darling children playing with their food. Our beloved dog licking syrup from the floor. Who could wish for more? I did love Sunday mornings, but needed more than love. I lacked the knack for easy pleasure. Those days I didn't know what to believe. So baffled was I by fury at the sight of you, walking freely in and out the door, whistling, happy, your red bandana dripping sweat into my eyes, as you tried again and again to kiss me.
So, talk a little bit about kind of where that poem began and what you may originally have thought it was about versus what it maybe turned out to be about.
Well, I think, and here, Stanley Kunin's one of my poetry idols, said to not go back and rewrite your early poems, but perhaps to revisit experiences with greater knowledge about yourself and about the experience. And I've taken that seriously. When I started writing that poem that I just read, I thought it would just be a celebration of early motherhood and not being a religious person. What did I really, what sustained me on a Sunday morning when others were at church or doing something spiritual? By the time I finished the poem, I realized how much joy I didn't allow myself to have and how much more love was offered to me there for the taking. And I was so caught up in my duty and my sense of being confined to not having the freedom that my husband took. And I could have taken for myself had I had any idea that I had the power to do so. So I really, how much resentment I allowed into my life, it was just not necessary. I didn't know that starting the poem. I had no idea. But by the time I finished the poem, and I don't know, you know how long it took or how many drafts, but, you know, I'm sure it took quite a while because every poem I write takes quite a while. I really learned something about myself by the end of the poem. And I hadn't intended to learn that, particularly because it wasn't very pleasant. Nevertheless, you know, that's what poems do. You start out one place and end up in another place. And I would not trade that experience for anything.
Do you remember the point in the process that the reveal came? Was there a line or an image or something that told you?
I don't remember a specific point, but I think that I wrote it in a pretty linear fashion. Sometimes I don't, but because there was enough narrative in the story that I don't imagine I got to what the poem was really about until, you know, I actually got there to the end. Mm-hmm. And then, well, there it was. If I've had kind of an interesting writing and revision process, I will staple the whole mess together in case I want to show a workshop when someone says, oh, I made 3 revisions of this, then I laugh, you know. Oh, really? That many? And then I'll get out my ream of paper.
So great.
That's but I couldn't put my hand on that right now. For one reason, when remodeling my house and my office, there's no words to describe how disorganized and horrible it is. So my big boxes of revision examples, I couldn't find them.
Right. We're almost out.
There are poems that begin, you know, one place and end up not even, you know, a kissing cousin to where they end up.
Yeah.
One poem, I was writing an essay, and I realized about halfway through that it had to be a poem instead, so I abandoned the essay, and it became a poem. And that's happened, actually, a few times.
So great. Oh, we're running out of time, but I want to, I want to continue this conversation, so we're going to find out a way to do that.
Okay.
And I'm sure our listeners would like to continue the conversation. I don't know if there are places you appear. I know you teach. Tell us a little bit about if we want more of you.
I don't think I have a public reading set up at this point, but I am doing a workshop. I'm doing a series of workshops for Tabat Bach at Golden West College, and the next one is October 13th, 10 to 2.
Oh, okay.
And there might be a slot or two available.
Where is that? I don't even know where that is. Where is that?
Pardon?
Where is the college?
It's at Golden West College.
Oh, okay, okay.
Huntington Beach, Golden West, and Crawford, I believe.
Okay, okay. Perfect.
Between those two streets.
And you have a? Do you have
and
a
I'm
website?
Sure I'm sure I'll be doing some public readings before too long, and trying to stay home for a couple of months and promote this book.
So, I love it. I love
I'm
it.
I'm open.
Donna Hilbert, and can we find you online? Are you
absolutely www.donnahilbert.com?
And I
have an active Facebook page, Donna Hilbert, poet and writer.
Yes. I love that.
I'm on Twitter, but I'm mostly sniping at politicians there, so something very interesting.
Those are good to read, too.
My aggression out early.
Me too, right. Well, congratulations. This is an amazing collection, and such a joy to bring you on and talk about it. And I look forward to
it. It's a joy to be here with you, Marie.
We're going to keep it going. All right. Donna Hilbert, thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.
The collection is Gravity. It is out and available now. It is just wonderful. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. So I really recommend, even if you are not a writer of poetry, I highly recommend any writer or civilized human being be a reader of poetry. And this is a very accessible, wonderful place to start. I know people feel intimidated by poetry. No reason with this. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned. There is more great music coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.